Greetings and good morning, everybody. Thanks for listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. It's 8 o'clock, and here's your local newscast for Monday, April 15th. A Democratic-sponsored bill that would make major changes to how Coloradans vote in the future gets its first hearing in a House committee at the state capitol today. KUNC's Nathan Heffel reports.
The bill aims to conduct most state elections via mail-in ballot and require county clerks to send those ballots to all eligible voters, including those deemed inactive in the past. It would also replace local precinct polling locations with county-wide vote centers for mail ballot elections. One of the more controversial measures would allow same-day voter registration. Current law requires a person be registered to vote 29 days before an election. The bill is backed by the state's county clerks, who say it will ultimately save taxpayers money and time. However, Republican Secretary of State Scott Gessler fears the possibility of widespread voter fraud if some of the changes are implemented. Sponsors of the bill, including Senator Angela Jaron of Pueblo, say the bill will actually reduce fraud. I'm Nathan Heffel.
At 4 p.m. on Tuesday, April 16th, the Blue Sage in Paonia will present a practical session to help people deal with a topic no one wants to talk about. KVNF's Marty Derlin has more.
Gene Siriani is trying to tell us something. As a healthcare provider, she's seen how the body wears out, gives up, or is wounded beyond repair. But most of us can't seem to communicate with one another about this most basic fact of our existence, that it will end.
We all know we're going to die, but we still don't talk about it. We still don't sit down and make those plans. Studies show that 70% of us would like to die at home, and 12 to 15% of us actually do die at home. Many of us are still dying with more pain and more suffering than we should have.
Siriani says that 4 out of 5 of us die without advanced medical directives. In fact, we rarely make any specific end-of-life desires known to our loved ones because we avoid the topic.
I mean, we can't even make that decision, so we expect our family and our friends to do it. Probably not the best way to deal with the end of your life.
Siriani and Carolyn Ringo will walk participants through The 5 Wishes, a series of questions that lets you consider what you want if you become seriously ill. Developed by a man who worked with Mother Teresa for more than a decade, it's a living will that includes not only your medical directives, but also your personal, emotional, and spiritual wishes. These considerations are, of course, connected. For example, if emergency medical people respond to a person who's having a heart attack, their sole aim will be to get the patient to the hospital alive, no matter how old or otherwise ill the person is.
1 out of 10 elderly, frail people who have cardiopulmonary resuscitation done on them survive, 1 out of 10. And most of them have some sort of tissue or organ damage after the cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So at the end of your life, having people jumping up and down on your chest is probably not what you want to have done. If you don't have a CPR directive, they will assume that you want CPR.
Things can get more confusing and complicated once you get to the hospital. There are questions about life support, about organ donation, about disposition of the body.
If we get into the hospital and we're unable to make decisions, the doc will, at that point, gather all the interested people that he recognizes can find, and they, as a group, will designate a person, and that person then becomes your proxy. But, I mean, if you haven't discussed with your family or your friends what it is you want at the end of your life, how can this person know? And if at the end of your life you've not designated anybody, the doc can't find anybody who will be your proxy, they will appoint a guardian. And a guardian can end up in the courts trying to figure out who's going to do it. So you're just kind of laying there waiting. And they're in court trying to figure out who's going to make the decisions. So I think the main thing here is talk about it.
If you've been putting it off, here's your opportunity to talk about death and dying and get a document in place. For KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin.
The Denver Post reports that state environmental overseers on Friday said Diesel Range Organics, detected in Parachute Creek near a hydrocarbon spill, have reached the gates to a town drinking water reservoir. The gates have been closed since the spill by Williams Energy Company's gas processing plant was reported last month. The results of water tests taken on April 6th and 7th showed Diesel Range Organics at 0.71 and 0.49 parts per million. Diesel Range Organics at a slightly higher rate of 0.73 parts per million had been found on the creek upstream of the suspected source of the spill. Also on Friday, cancer-causing benzene was detected in groundwater drawn from a test well about 10 feet from the creek at a concentration of 340 parts per billion, State Natural Resources spokesman Todd Hartman said. Colorado's limit for benzene in water is 5 parts per billion. Another monitoring well is being drilled in that area. Williams crews are sucking up contaminated groundwater from interceptor trenches dug near the stream, as close as 10 feet from the creek. They also are pumping groundwater for the purpose of drawing the flows away from the creek. Williams officials reported, quote, contaminated soil, end quote, to the state on March 8th. Cleanup crews rolled into action about a week later, after company officials reported liquid hydrocarbons had been spilled. Earlier this week, Williams said the spill actually happened in December and that they stopped it on January 3rd. But state officials still are investigating that scenario. Marilyn Stone noted on IC Change that she hasn't heard the chorus of leopard frogs she usually hears by this time of year and wondered about the effect of a nearby wetlands that dried up last fall. KVNF's Marty Derlin has some answers from a scientist who studies these amphibians.
Max Joseph is a graduate student in ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado. Last year, he took part in a study of leopard frogs in and around Boulder, going so far as to equip 13 of the 4.5-inch, 33-gram frogs with radio transmitters. Following their movements, Joseph and his colleagues were able to glean new information about the once plentiful amphibians.
Historically, it was one of the most abundant frogs in wetlands across the U.S., but it's gone through declines in Colorado in the last century. So there still are some populations, but they're much less abundant and much less common than they used to be.
Joseph says there are multiple reasons for the leopard frog decline, including habitat loss and fragmentation, urban development, environmental contaminants, introduced fish, invasive species, and a fungus with a name that's hard to pronounce.
It's called Batrachochytrium dendrobatidus. And this chytrid fungus has been responsible for amphibian declines worldwide. And we know that it does occur locally, although the exact effects of this fungal disease still remain unclear.
But drought also plays a large role in the frog's ability to survive.
Generally, drought can reduce breeding habitat by causing fewer temporary ponds or faster drying of temporary ponds. Also, drought can reduce overwintering survival if there's a permanent wetland that's important for overwintering. And that wetland becomes more shallow, the likelihood of that wetland freezing completely is greater during winter, and that can have negative effects as well.
The study Joseph completed last year showed that frogs will go a long way to find a good place to overwinter.
We observed adult frogs moving up to 500 meters over the course of just a few days, and they were moving all at the same time away from the breeding site, and we were able to figure out what the movement corridor was. And so it turns out that the frogs were moving along depressions in open fields in order to get to a ditch system. Once they reached the ditch, then they followed that ditch to the overwintering site. Typically, leopard frogs will try to find a permanent water body that won't freeze completely, and what we think they do is they sort of burrow into the substrate, in other words, the bottom of the pond, in order to try to avoid freezing. And then they go into a dormant state throughout the winter until temperature is warm and they can reemerge and begin feeding and breeding.
As far as Marilyn's question about the frogs next door, Joseph says it's really too early to tell.
So certainly if this pond was an important overwintering site and it dried up, that could be problematic. But we also know that leopard frogs often breed in temporary ponds. So it could be that they just haven't started breeding yet. I think that comment was prior to this last snow event. From the amphibian's perspective, it probably wouldn't have been a great idea to breed prior to a big snow. I mean, the eggs don't really deal too well with freezing and extreme cold. It's still maybe a little bit too early to know how leopard frogs are doing this year.
For Marilyn, the leopard frog's call is a creaky door chirp. Max Joseph had another description of it.
Well, have you ever had a balloon and maybe your hands are a little bit wet or a little bit sweaty and you kind of squeeze the balloon and move your hand so that you have a squeaking sound?
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like that.
Can you imitate it?
No, unfortunately I can't. I wish I could, though. That would be a really effective tool in the field if you were trying to find them.
For I See Change at thealmanac.org and KVNF News, I'm Marty Durham.
And that concludes your daily newscast on Monday. For KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, I'm Eric Gould. Have a great day, everybody, and thanks so much for listening.